Hey there, podcast listeners. It's Courtney here with a special offer just for you. My new book is coming out in April. It's called Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief. It's all about grief and sorrow and the ways that birds and birding can bring us to a place of hope. It's a book of faith. It's a book of humor. We would love to give you a 20% discount. You can use this code, IVPPOD20. That's IVPPOD20. That code will give you 20% off and free shipping anywhere in the US when you order from ivpress.com. Pick up your copy of Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief today. Hope is the thing with feathers.
Hope is the thing with feathers.
That's like a bird.
Like a bird.
That perches in the soul.
That perches in the soul. Welcome to the Thing with Feathers podcast, a podcast about birds and hope. I'm your host, birding enthusiast, Courtney Ellis. Welcome back to the Thing with Feathers podcast. I'm here today with a fabulous guest. He is the editor of Birding Magazine, the author of bird books, as well as articles and papers on birds and nature. He's a frequent speaker at bird festivals and state ornithological society meetings, and he's involved in the American Birding Association's Young Birder Programs. Ted Floyd comes to us today from the great state of Colorado. Welcome, Ted.
Thank you, Courtney. Thank you for having me.
It's so good to have you. You're one of those folks, I've read so many of your articles and books that I feel like I know you, but this is the first time I've gotten to speak to you in person. So I'm just really honored that you've come on the show.
I'm glad to be here again. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Will you tell us, first of all, just a little bit about your own journey into birding? I'm always curious for folks who have made this their life's work. How did it begin for you?
Yeah, well, I'm old enough now that I can really say it has been pretty much my entire life. That wasn't the case when I was younger, but yeah, I've been doing this since I was about 12, which is now, that makes this a very substantial fraction of my life. So I got started, I guess, back in 1980, and things were different back in the day. Certainly the birding community in the United States and really worldwide wasn't nearly what it is today. So there were far fewer of us, and resources and knowledge and information were sort of few and far between. But I found my way eventually to libraries and museums, and then eventually to real life human birders. And sort of the rest, as they say, is history. So just sort of a passion for birds. I can't really explain where it came from or sort of what event precipitated it, but it was briskly underway by the time I was midway through middle school.
Mm, it started early.
Relatively speaking. Yep.
I'm always a little bit envious of folks for whom it started early. I started in my mid-30s, and I feel like I have all these decades that I could have been out birding, and I'm trying to catch up now. But one of the things I appreciate about your writing is you're really generous with the idea that birding is a wide net. The bar is low. You know, you can get into birding at any phase of your life, and there's no shame in being a beginner. And you do a really good job of introducing and explaining some of the best birding tools. Your book, How to Know the Birds, was one of the first I stumbled upon in my local library when I got into birding. So tell us a little bit about eBird and how to use it as a beginner and some best practices, because you can also go a little bit wrong with eBird. You can make people crazy with eBird if you don't know what you're doing.
So I suppose we should probably define what eBird is all about. So eBird is this crowdsourced database that comes out of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. And it's a place to share your bird sightings and also detections by ear. That doesn't have to be just birds that are seen with all the world. So the idea is that you go out and you look for birds and you make note of not only what species of birds you saw, but how many you saw or heard, and you upload what's called a checklist, and it pretty much instantly goes to everybody with an internet connection, which is several billion of us now. And so that's just really, really exciting that everything we do sort of has this connectivity to it. You know, anybody has access to our sightings. We have access to everybody else's sightings. And then what's really exciting is that really big pictures emerge from all of this. You know, just you e-birding or just me e-birding is, you know, just a single isolated sort of almost like arbitrary anecdotal, you know, nothing, but with millions of us doing this, incredibly exciting and meaningful and powerful trends arise from it all. So that's really, really cool. You also mentioned, I think, maybe it's creating this memory, but best practices or techniques or something for being an e-birder. It's funny, I was just asked to write about that for our state journal just a little while ago. And, you know, I had three lines of advice. I don't really remember all three of them in particular, but they all sort of just boiled down to, you know, just, you know, go slow, you know, take it easy, sort of check your work, you know, look again at what you, for a second, third time, perhaps, at, you know, what you written down. They're just simple data entry errors that I make, I'll be honest with you, almost daily. It's just really, really easy when you're going fast to type in, I don't know, white winged when you meant white rumped or something like that. So eBird is very, very easy to use, and that's wonderful. And I think that's sort of maybe more than anything else, just why it has been so fantastically successful. But it does behoove us to spend just a little bit of time, as I said, checking our work. I spend a lot of time doing eBird workshops, and the following may be, I'm sure to say this or not, a little bit daunting or off-putting, but I'll say it anyhow. I really feel that we should probably spend as much time creating and proofreading and checking and curating our checklists as we spend birdwatching. So if I'm out there, let's say birdwatching for 45 minutes, and I take a few photos and make a few audio recordings with my phone and maybe a behavioral note or two, so that's 45 minutes there. I think it takes about 45 minutes to really sort of get it right in a properly curated eBird checklist as well. Now, I'm a professional editor and sort of a lifelong purist and stickler for these matters, but there's just something wonderful about a well-curated eBird checklist. I'm also old enough now that, you know, as I go back through my, we talked about when I got started way long, long ago, my earliest field notebooks, you know, did the jottings down that I did in the 1980s. And it's just so wonderful to go back and see those carefully handwritten field notes. And you know, people say, how do you remember that, you know, from 40 years ago? I think, well, it's because I have the notes right here in front of me. So there's something really kind of personal and powerful about it as well. There's something just satisfying about looking at it, in my case now, an eBird checklist from 17 or 18 years ago and sort of reliving the experience of being there again.
It's amazing how those written records or those digital now records can take you back. You know, you're back there. You're standing in that field once again because you've got that list in front of you. What a gift.
Yeah, sometimes when I think of one of the things my parents did right, and I'm thinking of my mom in particular, you know, she really almost sort of compelled us, you know, some amount of duress there to, you know, to keep a journal during our teen and high school years. And it actually really clicked with me. I mean, it wasn't something I resisted much at all, teenage rebellion notwithstanding. But it's really, really cool that, you know, you could put me on the spot here. You could say, you know, go back to your journal from, I'm just making this up here, April 1st, 1984. And like, by golly, there's actually a record of what I saw that day. And I actually probably remember it without even having to go to the journal, which is really cool.
It's so cool. Tell us how to make a good sound recording, because that's something I have not done much yet myself. I do a lot of eBird checklists, but it feels like the sound recording is scary to me. There's a lot of traffic noise in the background, or I'm at a playground with kids. How do you get a good sound recording of a bird that you would upload to eBird?
Yeah, I would say just jump in, just dive in. Honestly, turn on your phone, which is probably on already. Push the red button. This is kind of important. Make sure that the microphone is pointing toward the bird, not toward your mouth. Stop moving. You know, any little noise that you make, rustling, just footsteps, breathing, will be picked up and heavily amplified. So, you know, stand stock still with the phone sort of as far away from you as possible. Hold your arm straight out toward the bird in the direction of the bird. As you know, the phones have some directionality to them. So, you know, point it really right at the bird and you will get a serviceable recording just from your phone. Now, you can certainly upgrade to better equipment than a phone. However, most of the recent iPhones are eminently adaptable for very, very simple hardware, just, you know, little contraptions that, you know, boost the amplification, for example. And just like a 10 decibel boost can really improve the quality of recording. Mm-hmm. Those are incredibly inexpensive. I mean, we're talking, you know, small tens of dollars, you know, $20, $30, $40. This is not, you know, a major investment at all. However, you can get perfectly serviceable recordings just with your phone. So you have this recording, and then the next question is, what do you do with it? And then I would urge almost anybody just to, when I say invest, I don't really mean pay for anything because it's free, but find some online software for post-processing audio. It's amazing how, you mentioned like traffic and road noise, you can just edit that right out with just a very usually simple, like one click macro, maybe a two click macro. And you'll edit out your breathing, your rustling, whatever, you know, sort of fumbling around there is at the beginning and the end of the recording. A phone recording without any gadgets or hardware other than the phone itself and some amount of post-processing with free software can result in really high quality and very beautiful recordings.
That's really helpful. I'm gonna tuck that phrase just jump in into my pocket because sometimes I'm in a room full of non-birders. I'm a pretty knowledgeable birder. In a room full of actual birders, I'm such a novice. And so I walk that line where I'm like, how much do I know? Do I know enough to be able to do this? And that reminder that you learn through doing and you learn through practice and you learn through just diving in is a good one, I think, for all of us.
Yeah, I'll also say that what's so exciting about being a birder in the 2020s is that our phones really are making audio recordings that are as good as the best equipment was creating, let's say in the 1990s, when nobody had access to this material unless, you know, they were, you know, the tiny handful of sound recordists who were lugging around these, you know, literally, you know, multi-pound contraptions that, you know, back-breaking, you know, really cumbersome equipment. You can just go out with your phone now and make like an exciting new discovery here in Colorado where I live. We're really trying to figure out the flight calls of red crossbills. And this is really sort of a cutting edge problem in bird identification. And I'm cutting corners a little bit here in what I'm saying, but basically they can only be identified by the flight calls. That's not totally true, but that's a major component of their identification. And you just need to stick your phone in the air when you hear crossbills going over. And you'll make like an original contribution to science within 15 minutes of getting home and uploading it to eBird. You're really working out where these different crossbills occur and to some extent how to identify them also.
And how cool is that, that we can make actual contributions to real life, real time, important science as lay people? You know, I'm a mom and I work at a church and I'm not scientifically trained, but to know that my own discoveries can be useful in the world of ornithology is an exciting thing.
Yeah, it's exciting. I think, you know, I don't want to sort of get too carried away here for the handful of folks who really want to get into the discipline of the learning and discovery on their own, that is very much a possibility. You can also, and I don't mean this in a bad or catty way at all, you can just ask somebody for help. Hey, I've got this recording here. And well, let's use crossbills again as an example. Cornell actually has a designated team of experts who are and they're human beings, they're not computers, who are fastidiously just going through all of the crossbill recordings out there and figuring out what you have found. So you don't have to do any of the work. Now, I personally enjoy the challenge of but you don't have to do that. Another good example of that comes with, we should talk about photos as well. We are discovering so much about molts and plumages and just field marks that we didn't know about until 10 or 15 years ago. The Macaulay Library now has, it changes every day here, but you know, I think like 55 million photos. And I know that a good example is that Peter Pyle in California is basically sort of going through the database for species that are of particular interest to him, like ruby-throated and black-chinned hummingbirds, and just discovering things about the molts and plumages of, let's say, hummingbirds that were not known at all until recently. It's just an incredible resource. Now, if you're into that sort of thing and you want to, you know, look for patterns of molt on your own, hundreds or thousands of photos of hummingbirds, you can do that. You can also just upload the images and an expert will find them soon enough and discover something.
It's so cool. So we're going to move from eBird to Birding Magazine, which there are a lot of bird magazines out there. Birding is my favorite. I watch the mailbox for Birding Magazine. The issue where we get a new sticker for the bird of the year makes me so excited. I fight with my five-year-old over those stickers we've learned to share. How did you first get connected with birding? Tell us a little bit about your history there.
Yeah. So I mean, I've really, I love to say that I've grown up with Birding Magazine. It's literally sort of a true statement. The very first issue of Birding Magazine, it had a different name at the time, is in the year 1968, and it was quirkily numbered volume zero. Well, I was also 0 years old in 1968, and then by 1969, I was 1 year old. And I think it's so like the fates were aligned or something like that, the fact that it started in year zero when I was also year zero. So I have very literally grown up with Birding Magazine and the American Birding Association. We came into existence at the exact same time. I've certainly known about Birding Magazine really for as long as I've been a birder. There was an article by Paul Lehman on was then called the Thayer's Gull that came out in 1980. And Thayer's Gulls were a bit beyond my ability in 1980, but I just remember reading that article and being so taken with it. The idea that Paul Lehman was but a sprout at the time. We're all a bit older now, but he wasn't quite a kid, but he wasn't much more than a kid either. You know, could just figure out brand new things about the identification of a really, really difficult bird. So I was really kind of hooked on Birding Magazine by 1980. And then I was a member of the ABA sort of off and on during my high school and college years, you know, just sort of whenever I could remember to pay for it or something like that. And really, I became quite interested in the ABA by the mid-1990s. I remember an experience I had while doing field work in graduate school in the early 1990s. And a friend, Charlie Black, just said, you know, if you just want to know about birds, you have to read Birding Magazine. And that just sort of hit me like the proverbial ton of bricks. And, you know, that's now 30 plus years ago, but that really stuck with me. And then when the opportunity to become the editor of Birding arose now 22 years ago, in 2002, I leapt at it and I've been with Birding and the ABA ever since.
Mm. It is just such a fabulous publication, and it walks that line between beautiful scientific pieces and things that are really accessible for new birders. And that's a feat. How do you decide what goes in? How do you decide what stays out?
Well, honestly, I think you just hit the two nails on the head there. So the idea absolutely is to try to communicate knowledge about birds as broadly as possible. But the knowledge part of it, the information part of it is central to what we're all about as well. So I really, I love to tell contributors that, you know, I still want to learn something new from an article that we ran in Birding. You know, sometimes I wouldn't have been doing it for as long as I've been doing it. You know, somebody might think, well, there's nothing else to learn. And that's just really not the case at all. We were just in-house at the ABA the other day doing, and we do this every issue. It's a very healthy and appropriate thing to do, sort of what we call a little postmortem for each issue. And it's not as bad as it sounds. You know, we just review, you know, sort of what worked well. And one article in the March issue of Birding that I think really struck a chord with a lot of people was by Steve Hampton up in Port Townsend, Washington, on avian flu. And we were trying to sort of figure out what was it that sort of, you know, attracted us to this article. And I think what it is that there was so much information in there that none of us knew about. Now, we've all heard of bird flu or avian flu, avian influenza, but Steve, who is a lifelong professional biologist, just marshaled so much evidence in his, I mean, a lot of incredibly recent, you know, I mean, he was still making changes to the manuscript as we went to press, but it was really, really current, really, really up to date. And, you know, his basic idea was that bird flu, which is something we often think about as, oh, it's in chicken farms or it's on some other continent, is very much here in his case, in the Western United States right now. So the articles that can be apprehended by anybody, but that have, as you use the word science, but, you know, I'll expand that more broadly to information, knowledge, understanding about birds.
Yeah, there's an accessibility, but there's also a reach in the magazine, which I think is really a brilliant thing that new birders can find their way in, but then there's also something to reach for and something to learn. And I love that you, after birding for so many decades, part of your goal is that you'll learn something new. Because if you're going to learn something new, the rest of us are going to learn something new.
I hope there's something new in every contribution in birding. I mean, obviously your mileage may vary, as they say. And you know, for example, you're just not as interested in something else. I also wanted to say, even though you didn't ask me about this too, is that when it comes to new, something that's so important also is new voices, new perspectives, new narratives. And we really strive hard at Birding. And by the way, I'm not the only editor of Birding. I have two colleagues, Michael Redder and Frank Izaguirre, but we really strive to reach out to voices that are, you know, for sure authoritative and credible and knowledgeable, but that also reach across a broad spectrum of experiences and backgrounds and perspectives. I personally have been especially attracted to our incredibly brilliant young birders and ornithologists who just know so much and are acquiring knowledge so quickly, but also just reaching out to demographics that have been historically underrepresented or just not represented at all, honestly, in the American birding scene has been really, really a top priority for us. And I just think it has really expanded our knowledge and our ultimately our appreciation and our concern for bird life.
I very much appreciated the diversity of the magazine, because the stereotype is birding is for old white dudes, right? And I'm not an old white dude. And I think you do a really good job of fostering that collegiality among authors of different backgrounds. And as a reader, I really appreciate that intentionality, and I've noticed it. So thank you for doing that.
There's intentionality about that. And it really just sort of trying to get representation from as many, we like to say, authorial voices as possible. But again, always with an eye to, it's not an either or thing here, but this is an authoritative, credible, highly informed voice as well.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about your work with the ABA's Young Birders. You mentioned that was something that's kind of giving you hope these days. What's going on in the world of young birding, and how are you involved?
That's funny. I guess I could have preempted that question with my little riff there on young birder contributions to our magazine. But, so the ABA Young Birder programs, which are headed up by Laura Gerard, who's the coordinator or director of that whole program, have long focused on sort of two, twin pillars or programs. So one of them is our summer camps, and then the other is this Young Birder of the Year mentoring program. And I used the expression earlier, your mileage may vary. For some kids, it's really camps, and for others, it's really the mentoring program. For some, by the way, it's both of those as well. The camps are just a wonderful opportunity to go birding, but also to do natural history more broadly with superb peers, young people, and also top flight instructors as well. And I might point out they're quite economical as summer camps go as well. So that's really exciting. My guess is that by the time this podcast comes out, that the summer 2024 camps are all booked out by now, but we'll look for 2025. And then the Young Bird of the Year mentoring program is something that just is sort of a rolling, through the year program that you can get involved in as well. I love the camps, and I actually, I'm a guest at Camp Colorado every year, and I'm involved in the mentoring program at all. I will say that my personal emphasis connection with all of this is involving our young birders in the magazine. And we've had marvelous contributions in the very recently published March 2024 issue of Birding. We have a state-of-the-art feature on the identification of Cooper's hawks with some digression into sharp-shinned hawk and American goshawk. So, these very difficult exhibitors. And every single image and caption in there is by somebody 19 years old or younger. And there are, I believe, 17 contributors to that. And, every single one of them was, born after, help me out with the math here, 2007. and I think that's just really, really cool that, this really, solid, these are kids. So, it's sometimes very intense and sort of advanced bird knowledge is coming out here. And all of it is has been generated in this particular case by people who were born long after I came on board at Birding Magazine, which I think is so cool.
I loved that piece in the issue. I have three young kids, and we're allowing them to develop their own interests. But I do things like I leave Birding Magazine laying around, and I leave it open to certain pages, and to watch them walk over and kind of start to explore. And wait, this photo was taken by someone my age. That's exciting. That's amazing. Our 5-year-old knows how to use Merlin. We get Cooper's hawks in our backyard. That was a really perfect gateway piece. I learned things, but also they learned things. So that was a win in our house for sure. Great. And folks can still get the March issue of Birding Magazine. If you don't know what we're talking about, go out and grab a copy, because it was a particularly lovely, lovely, lovely issue. I love them all, but that was a great one. Let's talk for a minute, Ted, about your great book that I know it came out a few years ago, but it's been sitting on my nightstand, and I pick it up all the time. Your book, How to Know the Birds, The Art and Adventure of Birding. As I said, I picked this up as a very, very new birder 4 years ago, and it was so invitational. You open with the story of going to the park with your preteen son and using eBird and finding bush tits. And I was like, wait, there's eBird. There are all these things. And then it moves into this episodic one-page little vignette about different birds. The line that made me laugh out loud was, ducks in August are a mess. And you write about molting, but you take us on this kind of whimsical, bite-sized journey. How did this book come to be?
Wow. Yeah. So there's actually there's quite a story there as well. I'll try to give you the short version. So the editor for the book, Susan Hitchcock, and I have been in conversation for a long, long time now about what sort of might be the ideal bird book, you know, if you could just sort of in a utopia, you know, write a bird book, what would it be like? And we sort of schemed and plotted, and I thought we were having this very, hypothetical conversation about what such a book might be like. And then at one point she just sort of sprung the trap on me, like, well, do you want to write it? And I thought, well, of course I want to write it. So I have to give sort of credit where credit is due. The biggest sort of picture, that the broadest concept, really came from Susan as much as from me. And the birding gods smiled upon us. The powers that be at National Geographic were quite favorable, and we enlisted the services of a marvelous artist, Jonathan Schmidt, and had some superb I don't want to call them fact checkers. They were more exalted than that. But people who really sort of read the entire manuscript and made some really, really key suggestions as we went through with the process. But it came together gratifyingly quickly. The thing just sort of flowed for me. As you said, the introduction, you know, just was about a real life birding story. Most of those vignettes in there, although I kind of cloak my personal, you know, first person voice there, those are real stories that happened to me. The very, very last chapter in there, I think it's chapter, they're 200 in there, or they're 100. I can't remember. Is it 200 or 100?
I think it's 200.
200, yeah. it's 200.
It's 200.
Yeah. So that Screech Owl story there. The illustration there by Schmidt is of an owl in the park that I grew up in 40 years. I didn't grow up in the park. I grew up near the park 40 years ago. And I asked him, like, how did you so accurately capture, I don't know, the experience of being there? This is such an internet age thing. He Googled the park and found the lamppost where the owl might have been singing from. But yeah, the story, I mean, it is to some extent personal. It's sort of a reflection on sort of where I've come from over the decades. But it was very much, and you've already mentioned this, sort of identified, or, you know, intended to be a sort of a walkthrough for a year of birding for anybody who just sort of wants to get started. And it begins very fundamentally, as you said, with a story about just, you know, going out on a sort of rainy summer evening and seeing bush tits. And by the end of it, we're talking about ducks in August being a mess. So,
and they are. They're such a mess in August. The molting is just so undignified for everyone. I feel for them.
Yeah. Let me also say about ducks in August, though, that yes, ducks, most ducks in August are messy looking because they're in the process of this very, very rapid molt. They have this quick plumage in the middle of the summer. It's called the eclipse, or it's actually the alternate plumage of the ducks. It happens really, really quickly. And it was really quite misunderstood. I'd say entirely misunderstood until the 21st century. I mentioned Peter Pyle earlier. It was really Peter more than anybody else who figured out what ducks are actually doing in August. But yeah, the males in particular have this very, very rapid, I'm trying to use informal language here, but, you know, change in appearance during the late summer months. And then they, if you will, sort of go back to quote unquote normal by fall, when they acquire their, you know, very, you know, I don't know, sort of immaculate and pristine colors.
Always takes me back to junior high when we were all walking around being really awkward and growing into our shoes. And, you know, like, birds go through that too, but they have to go through it every year. We most of us get off with 3 years of junior high and we get out of it. But yeah, some of us, myself included, are still in our awkward phase. It's okay. We just embrace it. So, Ted, what's going on in Colorado in the world of birding around this time of year? What migrants do you usually see? What are you excited about as we get into the depths of spring?
Yeah. And just to be clear before I answer that question or attempt to answer that question, we're addressing a US-based audience here, or worldwide?
For the most part, we have some listeners around the world, but largely US.
So April, early April in Colorado is still sort of winter. Spring comes late to the Rockies. Even down here, I live out on the plains a short distance. I mean, the mountains only 10 miles away from me, but, you know, we get sometimes heavy snowfalls, you know, into late May here. So it's still pretty sort of wintry out here, cool days and snowstorms. But there is a trickle of birds starting to come back by this time of the year. Birds like Say's Phoebe and Common Grackle, Cinnamon Teal, American White Pelican, Greater Yellow Legs, Mountain Bluebird, you know, they're on the move right now. But we can still have you know, wintry days here, you know, well into the end of April. I think it was, you know, there's that famous saying that March comes in like a lion and goes out like a lamb. That's a very East Coast centric view of things. I think it was, don't quote me on this. I think it was Robert Frost who wrote a poem about April. He said that April is much more fickle than March is. I may have the author wrong, but I know that the subject matter is correct. And that would have been about New England. But that is so true of the month of April in Colorado. We could have, you know, like a blizzard, you know, 2 weeks from now. We could also have, you know, sunny 70s and broadwing hawks sailing over or something like that. So it's a time of transition and uncertainty. There's certainly no leaves on the trees yet. It's usually cold and wet, and but birds are coming back and spring is in the air.
Where are you finding hope these days?
Well, that's a broad question.
Purposefully so.
In the world of birds, or just in life in general? Or?
So the theme of our show is birds and hope. And we take that line from Emily Dickinson, that hope is thing with feathers. So we like to cast it in a broad way. So it could be in your own personal life. It could be in the world of birding. I talk to a lot of folks who work in the world of birding and see such devastating effects of climate change and population declines. And, you know, where are the bright spots for you? Where are you finding hope?
And sorry, you mentioned Emily Dickinson.
Yeah.
It's funny, you sort of catch me off guard here. So I know the poem you're talking about. She also has a poem about she never names the bird, but it's clearly an American robin. A bird came down the walk. And this is the time of year when robins are sort of at their peak hopefulness here in Colorado. There's a line in there that I've just carried with me my whole life about the velvet head of the robin. It's such a marvelous description. Again, the bird's never named, but it clearly is an American robin. And there's just something about a seeing a robin, which is one of the most familiar birds, maybe the most familiar bird in the United States, especially in April, sort of going about its thing, being successful, raising it, beginning to raise its young. I mean, it comes a little bit later here in Colorado, but certainly courting and nest building will begin very soon here. So there's something about the experience of connecting with birds. And I don't mean connecting to them, but like kind of, associating with, or sort of, embracing, or, bringing on board, their, I'm being very anthropomorphic here, but their lives and their concerns and the sorts of things that birds are all about. And, just getting out and realizing that, I have another birding friend, Stephanie Seymour, who has an album called There Are Birds. I mean, there are actually birds in this world, and there are lots of them, and they're eminently, findable and observable. And I think very relatable, as well. So, the experience of seeing something like a robin coming down the path and wanting to reach out and stroke its velvet head, again, shout out to Emily Dickinson right there, is a hopeful sort of thing. The the availability, the accessibility, the constant companionship of birds is something that keeps me going day after day after day. I have this dirty little secret that probably some of our listeners know about already, that I go bird watching like every day. Like, I've never not gone birding for a day in my birding life, which is now well over 40 years. And I can't say that hope is the only thing that motivates me. There's really sort of a discipline there. It's like, it can be an intellectual discipline, an artistic discipline, more of like an emotional discipline, really. But just getting out there and realizing that wherever we are and whoever we are and whatever sort of life circumstance we're in, we can find birds. I've had powerful testimonies from people who are in prison who have, powerfully connected with birds, from people who are homebound. They can't get out of their homes, but they still connect with or relate to birds. And then also with people who, although they are more mobile than somebody who can't get out of their home or can't get out of an institution, nevertheless have lives that are constraining, seriously so in one way or another. And birds bring us hope, I think, just by virtue of their being there and being dependable and being reliable. And I've just never met somebody who doesn't really have access to birds. They're always out there.
Every day.
Birds are out there every day and every night.
No, that you've been birding every day. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's
me. And now that I remember, you do mention it in the book. But that is a deep spiritual practice.
I can't resist pointing out, since apparently you didn't know that. So I'm the world's record holder for the continuous days of e-birding streak. I'm well into the 6,000s now. I started my streak when my youngest son was born, and he's almost 18 now. So I haven't missed a day of e-birding since January 1st, 2007.
That's amazing. Does Guinness cover that? Are you in the book?
I don't think they would cover something like
that. I think they should, Ted. I think you need your name in there. That's rad. And that is such a good reminder, because I think, you know, I have young kids in this very full life, and there are days I'm like, I just don't have the time for it. But even if it's just 5 or 10 minutes, you can find 5 or 10 minutes. I waste that much time on Twitter every day, right? Like, it's about priority. It's about choices. Yeah.
So we have another article in the March issue of Birding that we were talking about by Holly Merker on the value of going bird watching for wellness and not just for mental health wellness, which I think has been widely written about recently, but also for physical, mechanical, issues other than mental health wellness. And one really, really cool report that report that she's discussed or cited in her article was about the positive impacts of taking time out to go birdwatching on your own productivity. So imagine that, I'm stealing this from Holly's article, but imagine that you're having an incredibly busy and stressful day with too many things coming at you. Probably sounds like your life and my life. And just, there's so much going on. It turns out that if you go out for 15 minutes, okay, so if you quote unquote wasted 15 minutes of your day, you actually more than make up for that in the productivity when you come back in from birdwatching. Now, by the way, that probably applies to looking at butterflies or going on a run or something like that. But, this is not just some sort of, pie in the sky, new age. Oh, well, I got centered when I went out. They've actually, formally, credibly, researched this. And people who actually go bird watching, by the way, going out for 8 hours, you probably will lose 8 hours of your day. But 15 or 20 minutes actually more than pays for itself in the increase in productivity later in the day after you get back in from bird watching. So I mentioned discipline. So that's part of the discipline there. But I don't think that's really the motivation at all for me. I mean, it's great that increased productivity is a byproduct of all of this. But yeah, just that discipline of, going out there sort of, I don't want to say I'm tuning out. I think in some ways I'm sort of, tuning in more than anything else, but just usually by myself, me, the birds, I typically have a camera and a voice recorder with me just in case. And sometimes 15 minutes becomes 2 hours and 15 minutes. And those are oddly the most productive days of all. So
That is a word. That is a word. So we're coming to the part of the podcast where I'm going to ask you the hardest question. Mm-hmm. Are you ready? Are you ready?
I think you're going to ask me the question whether or not I'm ready. So let's go.
Bring it on. All right, Ted, today, as of today, what is your favorite bird?
Oh, wow. That is an interesting question. It's one I think about a fair bit. It's one I get asked all the time. People have been asking me probably from day one sort of what my favorite bird is. So certainly there are cliches. What bird did you see? In my case, what's the bird that you saw most recently? What's the bird that you're looking at right now? I am tempted to say it is, whatever I saw a moment ago or an hour ago or a day ago or something like that. And by the way, I don't mean to dismiss that. I think the idea that whatever is in front of you right now is your favorite bird is indeed a special bird. But I'm going to answer the question, I think, the way you want me to answer it, which is so, of course, there are birds that are just heart-stoppingly, eye-poppingly majestic and beautiful to look at. Orioles and tanagers and buntings, or farther afield albatrosses, or hornbills, or bee-eaters, or something like that. And those do amaze and marvel me for sure. Honestly, I think the birds that most captivate me are what I call the stealth birds, the birds that are sort of right here in our neighborhoods that so few people know about and that do such marvelous and wonderful things. And I'll just, I've had sort of different favorite stealth birds from the very, very, very beginning. I mean, one of the birds that really got me going at the very, very beginning of my birding journey, well over 40 years ago now, were stealth birds. But I will answer your question now, and I'll give you a singular answer and say that it's the bush tit, which is the, it's literally the smallest songbird in North America, north of Mexico. The only birds in North America, north of Mexico, smaller than the bush tit are a few species of hummingbirds, but not all of our hummingbirds. It's just this utterly drab little brown bird. If it weren't for its tail, it wouldn't do much of anything at all. It's my favorite bird because every day we learn something utterly new about the bush tit. And some of that's in the book, and you alluded to the that opening vignette with the bush tits in there, but they're their complex social behaviors, their extraordinary vocalizations, their adaptability, they're bringing on new resources, rapidly invading new habitats. Apparently their behavior and their vocalizations are changing at the present time. Mm-hmm. There's so much to learn about bush tits. What we thought we knew about eye color with regard to male-female differences are not apparently correct. Whether or not bush tits have two or possibly more genders is up for debate right now. Their social behavior is so complex. And just everything about them so weird. Just here's one fun story. So they're so small and their nests are gigantic. They build enormous nests. You know, most birds build nests that are so small that they can barely fit in them. I was with a class at a local university recently, and we looked at magpies, which are very big birds, building their nests, which are quite big. But I was thinking about how relative to body size, the nest of a bush tit is much, much, much bigger. So just, I mean, you get this, like, the tiniest bird that builds the biggest nest, which I just think is such a wonder, not literally the biggest nest, but relative to its body size, it is immense. So I'll go with the bush tit, a tiny little brown, gray, drab bird, utterly devoid of any field marks, smaller than some hummingbirds, that so easy to overlook. They're so little. They, you know, they hang in shrubbery, as you can probably imagine from their name. They make vocalizations that are high pitched and sort of hard to hear. But they're out there. They're everywhere, and they're doing fascinating things. And I just a bush tit is one of those birds that I just cannot ever walk away from. If they usually walk away from me, they move pretty quickly through the bush. But if I'm with a flock of bush tits and they just are there for an hour and 45 minutes, then by golly, I will be there with them for an hour and 45 minutes too.
I love that, Ted. We're at 60 plus episodes and you're the first person who said their favorite bird is a bush tit. I love a bush tit.
All right.
So for all of our U.S. listeners, can they go out back and find a bush tit? Are they over most of the U.S.? Yeah,
good point. So the bush tit is essentially a Western bird. Shrublands in Western United States, also Canada and also far southwestern Canada as well. So they get about as far east as like the Edwards Plateau in Texas, San Antonio area. But basically, they're sort of like arid intermountain west, Rocky Mountains. And then I should also note that bush tits come in sort of regional flavors or varieties. You're in Los Angeles, is that right?
Orange County, yeah.
Oh, well, near enough, close enough, yeah. So the bush tits on the Pacific Slope are actually quite different from the bush tits in the interior west where I live. Ours have sort of dark ear patches, and yours have brown crowns. So they do look pretty different from region to region. And then in Mexico, the bush tits are paler, but with a strikingly black, we call them auricular or ear patches as well. So a lot of variety. But no, the bush tit is a Western U.S., Western North American bird, so Mexico and also extreme southwestern Canada as well. So, no, if you live in New York or Philadelphia or Boston, you'll have to come out to Colorado or Los Angeles and look at for bush tits with me or Courtney. So.
You really should. It's nice out here. You're all invited. Well, Ted, where can our listeners connect with you, find your work, connect with the ABA?
Yeah, so our website is incredibly simple. It's aba.org. Funny story there. The American Bar Association wanted to get into the action decades ago, but we got it first. So we are just that, aba.org. If you were to type in American Birding Association, you would find us as well. The website will be sort of your sort of one-stop portal to all things ABA, including if you want to contact for me and other staff at the American Birding Association. So aba.org is the place to go. And I think that the website is sort of set up in such a way that it can sort of send you down into whatever birding rabbit hole you wish to go. But I would start at aba.org and go from there.
It's a great site. And I want to mention also the ABA has a great podcast led most weeks by Nate Swick, the birding podcast. And that is well worth a listen if you want more and deeper information in the world of birds.
Yep. The American Birding Podcast is indeed worth a listen. I'm biased, of course, but I think I can sort of say that in an objective manner as well. Just Google it and you will find it for sure, or link to it from aba.org.
Ted Floyd, thank you so much for the gift of your time and your wisdom and your expertise. Final question, have you been out birding yet today or will it happen this afternoon?
I have been out already today. I saw some common and hooded mergansers this morning.
Oh, I love a merganser. They're so disheveled. Even when it's not August, they all look a little disheveled. Thank you so much, Ted.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
The Thing with Feathers is produced by me, Courtney Ellis. Many thanks to Del Belcher for the music, to Todd Peterson for the name inspiration, and to Emily Dickinson for the beautiful poem and for being in the public domain. Until next time, my friends, keep looking up.
Put a stick on your soul. Yes, it does.